First off, let's Representative Bunn, will you move the minutes of the last meeting?
I move the minutes of the last meeting.
Thank you. Any corrections anybody's got? All right. And we'll hold up on that. And also some announcements about re-referrals. House files 57, 210, 212, and 218 will be referred to the licensing subcommittee. And House file 196 is referred to the mental health division. All right. Well, today we're going to spend time on the health department, Department of Health, and some of the work that they do, and particularly in the area of public health, and also hear from some local public health folks about, because we have quite a few challenges facing us, and it's actually an area that covers a surprisingly broad spectrum of issues, and so I think it'll be a worthwhile use of our time. So, Commissioner Mananek?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Diane Mananek. I am the Commissioner of Health for the state of Minnesota, and I have with me today my wonderful technical expert, Jay McLaren. And I also have our assistant commissioners, Scott Light, Carol Wolverton, Dr. Crouch, and Margaret Kelly. Sorry about that, Margaret. But I really want to take an opportunity to thank you for allowing us to come and present an overview of the Department of Health. I want to give a brief description of what it is that we do in the department and then some get into detail with a few particular areas. Both the state and federal constitution include references to government's role in protecting the public's health. Minnesota law authorizes a shared role with local government for public health, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later. The MDH mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. I think one of the things that we need to be very clear on is that there is a difference between health care and public health. When we talk health care, we're focused primarily on an individual and their health issues, so the diagnosis, their treatment, their recovery. When we're talking about public health, we're talking about groups or communities and population health. And that can be based on geography, it can be based on shared characteristics. The other aspect of public health is it's about prevention, trying to intervene in the problem before it becomes a major issue. The National Institutes of Health, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, has identified the three core functions of public health that you see on the slide. As we talk this afternoon, hopefully you'll be able to pick out the examples as we give our presentation. This particular slide highlights the huge changes in the average life expectancy. It's actually an increase of 30 years, and this has occurred in the 20th century. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, our real key national partner, estimates 25 of those 30 years were actually the result of public health accomplishments. So when we talk about things like immunizations, food safety, motor vehicle safety, sanitation, the control of infectious disease, we actually see that translates into longer life expectancy. The 1976 Community Health Services Act established a framework and reorganized several hundred local public health agencies into what is now 53 county city health departments that cover the entire state. We share responsibility with tribal governments and public health agencies in working together to identify and address public health issues. Approximately $31 million annually is distributed under the local public health grant to 53 county health boards and 11 tribal governments. They in turn can leverage more funds at the local level. And certainly you are aware of this. This gets a great deal of attention in press. Minnesota has ranked number one in health 11 times since the national rankings began in 1990. We have never ranked lower than second. Believe me, there are many states that are targeting us and wanting to take over that ranking. We want to switch gears a little bit. We want you to take a look at a little of the work that gets done in our department, basically to show you some of the things that you and the taxpayers of Minnesota get from the Minnesota Department of Health. We know that even though Minnesota is ranked the healthiest state in the nation, when you look more closely at the numbers, you see that we have some significant health disparities that affect our populations of color and American Indians. In 2001, the department launched the Eliminate Health Disparities Initiative, and through our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. And the intent is to provide grants to community organizations that are working on culturally appropriate ways to eliminate health disparities. The particular areas that we look at are the areas of breast and cervical cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, HIV, AIDS, sexually transmitted infections, healthy youth development, violence and unintentional injury, and infant mortality. The legislature has allocated $10.4 million per biennium to provide eliminating health disparity grants directly to communities of color, American Indians, and the tribal governments in 42 of 81 counties. MDH is also where you get...
Commissioner, can I just stop for just a second there?
Absolutely.
And just to talk, $10.4 million a biennium is our current law? And has that changed? What's been the trend line on that in terms of the health disparities expenditures? Do you have any information on that?
Mr. Chairman, I have Margaret Kelly with me who would have more information on that.
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health. Our appropriations for eliminating health disparities have been relatively consistent since the appropriations began in about, I think it was 2000, 2001. We did make some minor reductions in 2003 when we faced a huge deficit, but for the most part, we maintained eliminating health disparities as a high priority for the department and made just minor reductions there.
Thank you very much.
When we look at the birth and death records, we have over 9 million birth and death records that is under our responsibility. A few years ago, the legislature moved from a paper system to an electronic system. And what that means then is we are linked with all the counties throughout the state. So you can now go to any county to request a birth or death record anywhere in the state and get it in real time. I think that this is a good example of how we really do try to serve the people of Minnesota more efficiently. MDH is also where you get the monitoring for infectious disease. Our epidemiologists and our laboratory workers work together very, very closely to monitor disease reports and laboratory specimens to quickly identify an outbreak so that we can mitigate it on the front end. Because of our pioneering work in the developing of the DNA fingerprinting, we are able to compare cases of infectious disease very quickly, and thus we are able to identify an outbreak at a very early stage. We did that, if you remember, a few years ago when, in fact, we had the issue of the steaks being sold on a door-to-door basis. We were able to pick up that this was a commodity that had fingerprinting similarities, and subsequently it got pulled, even though it was a national issue. It originated and was defined here in Minnesota. This is a picture from a few years ago of some of the more than 1,000 people who were offered immune globulin following a hepatitis A outbreak at a restaurant that sickened 39 people, three of whom were hospitalized. I think this highlights the close relationship that we have with local public health, and I know that they are here to also talk about that relationship. The public health and the interventions that we have often are a combination of state and local efforts. It means if we can find these outbreaks, if we can work together, we then can intervene. We have fewer cases and fewer people getting sick. A major activity since 9/11 has been bioterrorism and emergency preparedness. We receive federal funding that supports the state and local activities in improved communication and training, planning, and tabletop exercises. This is a particular picture from the anthrax scare that occurred shortly after 9/11, and our lab did testing for dozens of materials for possible anthrax. We didn't find any, and that was a good thing. Local, tribal, regional, and state efforts have greatly expanded our capacity to detect and respond to public health emergencies. I think if we look at the last 6 months alone, we have responded to a chemical fire in South St. Paul, mercury exposures in St. Paul and Eden Valley, and foodborne outbreaks in southern Minnesota. We are currently working with our partners at the CDC to receive approval of the Strategic National Stockpile Program, and what that requires is that we plan and demonstrate our ability to get medication to every Minnesotan within 48 hours of an event. Next, I'd like to talk about our newborn screening program. This is available to all of the approximately 72,000 babies born in Minnesota each year. Soon after birth, a small sample of blood is tested for 53 congenital and inherited diseases that can be life-threatening or severely debilitating if they're not detected. About 90 children per year are saved from mental retardation, severe disability, or even death. And I want to take just a couple minutes and tell you what I believe is the story of how this really works. We recently had an infant that was tested, and 3 days after the child was born, an abnormal result was found as a result of the testing. We do this in partnership with the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota. A member of our laboratory's on-call genetics team, when they reviewed the results, immediately picked up the danger, and they called the family, and they asked how the baby was doing. And the mother said that the infant was still asleep 4 hours after it had eaten, and yet it had eaten very, very poorly. When our person heard this, they told the parent to go get the baby up immediately. And the parent tried to get the child to wake up, and it wouldn't wake up. And so our specialist called 911, and the baby was rushed to intensive care at the University of Minnesota and was immediately put into the ICU in a deep coma. A week after that, the baby headed home. And it was because of the detection of what the condition was that they were able to intervene right away. The hospital was ready. This family had recently moved here from another state. And they asked what would have happened had I been in that other state, and that state doesn't test for this particular condition, and the baby would have died. So I think that's one of those stories that really puts the face on a program. The rates of invasive pneumococcal disease, including meningitis, used to be extremely high, or highest, in young children. A new vaccine, a pneumococcal vaccine, was licensed in 2000. Through education and coordination with healthcare providers, child care providers, parents, the number of cases of children under 5 has been dramatically reduced from an average of 197 cases in 96 to 2000 to about 54 cases per year in 2004-2005. That's in the Twin Cities alone. MDH is also where you get information about healthcare cost growth. In Minnesota, we can do comparisons with other states. We do comparisons throughout Minnesota. It's one example of the kinds of information and statistics that you can receive from the department. We know that this kind of information is invaluable to you as policymakers as you look for ways to improve health care in the state. Over the past couple of years, the Health Department, either alone or with the Governor's Health Cabinet, has begun addressing several serious health care issues. We've talked about electronic health records. We've created a consumer website. We deal with and manage the Merck Education Grant Program. We have looked at issues of uncompensated care and hospital community benefits. We also conduct the Governor's Fit School, the Governor's Fit City Program, as well as the PALA program in conjunction with General Mills. Approximately 687,000 Minnesotans receive care during the year from a nursing home or a hospital. We inspect over 1,000 licensed and certified health care facilities annually. We receive approximately 1,600 complaints. We investigate many of them. We investigate the concerns that are raised. We issue corrective orders and penalties if we confirm that a problem and neglect has occurred. Our Office of Rural Health provides a forum for addressing rural health care issues across the state. This office distributes grants and to maintain and improve the rural health infrastructure and workforce. This office also administers a statewide trauma system. This aims to ensure that the severely injured people across Minnesota are promptly transported and treated appropriately at the level of facility that is indicated given the severity of their injury. Last month, Fairview Southdale Hospital in Edina and Riverwood Healthcare Center in Aiken became the first two hospitals to be designated as Level 3 trauma hospitals under this new statewide system. In 2003, when we first came, we were one of only 14 states that didn't have a trauma system. We believe that this will translate into better care at the appropriate facility for patients and citizens in the state of Minnesota. The WIC program provides a healthy start for pregnant women, infants, and children up to age 5 through nutritional assessment and key nutritious foods. It's providing services to almost 135,000 Minnesota mothers and children. Another thing that I think is very important through the WIC program is it provides a gateway for other public health intervention efforts for women and children. And I don't think we can ever underestimate that. This slide highlights one of the problems associated with the increasing burden of chronic disease. The charts show the increases in obesity in the 1990s. Obesity, which is a largely preventable chronic condition, drastically increases the risk for many other chronic diseases. And I know that I'm not telling you something you don't know. When we look at the Minnesota population, nearly 60% of our population is categorized as overweight or obese. Over 13% of low-income children ages 2 to 5 that are participating in the WIC program are overweight. We have statewide plans for reducing the burden of chronic disease. We look at asthma, cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular. Chronic disease is a key contributor as we look at health care costs. These next three slides I just want to reference. These are, I don't want to say promotional. They're educational, informational items that we have passed out at the State Fair for the last two to three years. This was a fan of hand washing, and a soap company donated a packet of soap that we put in the center. We distributed 30,000 of these at the State Fair. The next year, we encourage people to make healthy choices in terms of behavior and exercise. And in 2005, we had 23,000 people that signed up, took a pledge to exercise most days of the week for 30 minutes, and in exchange received a green bracelet. This particular slide is a poster that if you've been in a physician's office or a hospital recently, you have probably seen. It is not just in Minnesota. It is across the country. It is also international. This poster was developed in our department a few years ago at the time of the flu season when we were trying to communicate that cough, cover your cough means not with your hand and then shake a hand, but cover into your sleeve. This has now been incorporated into schools. Young children are being educated on how to cough properly. My mission is to be able to get the media and the advertisers to do the same thing, and then I think we'll be able to really make an impact. I'd like to highlight a few environmental issues. In 2006, Minnesota was recognized by the National Groundwater Association for sealing more than 200,000 wells. Cumulatively, Minnesota seals more abandoned wells to prevent groundwater contamination than all other states combined. And I think that that's an important point because of the fact that we are so dependent on groundwater for our drinking water. We're also working with restaurant managers to develop food safety protocols and systems, not just inspections, to make sure that we have adequate and proper ways to protect food for food safety. Floods and tornadoes are a fact of life in Minnesota. In these situations, the health department quickly moves into action. We test well water for contamination. That becomes a free service in those areas. We provide advice about mold, food safety, immunizations for such things as tetanus in those situations. We've also been very involved these last years with the growing problem of methamphetamine in our state. This is a photo of a clandestine meth lab being cleaned up. And you probably heard that the governor has recently appointed a statewide meth coordinator. They will be housed at MDH, and so we will have a coordination of effort that will emerge from the health department in this particular area. We also are responsible for making sure that there is timely and appropriate disposition of the dead in a manner that protects the health and safety of those working in the profession, but also the general public. So when we talk about what are the priorities for MDH, we continue to work very, very hard in preparing for public health emergencies. We are conscious, very conscious, of our continuing efforts to eliminate health disparities. We also are very focused on preparing for our aging population. We want to work to improve the health and quality of our healthcare system and control the rising healthcare costs. We're very concerned about reducing the burden of chronic disease. At the same time, and always, we have to maintain the core functions of public health: the safe food and water, the immunizations, the newborn screening, the disease control. We have included two slides, and I'm not going to go through those, but those are for your review about where our funding comes from and then subsequently where it goes. And if you have additional questions on that, we can certainly have Margaret come and walk through that in greater detail. I've also included a slide for the MDH website. There's a wealth of information there. Someday, if you have all kinds of extra time on your hands, I would invite you to browse the website. We have our new location of our lab and our office building at the Orville L. Freeman office building, and then the lab building that's associated with that. I would extend an invitation to the members of the committee to come and to tour the lab to have an opportunity to really see for yourself what it is that occurs there. And, for example, to see our newborn screening program and what that means and to listen to the people who actually do the work. Final word about public health. Public health is one of the best investments that we can make. It's front-end care. We know it's long-term for results. And sometimes we get caught in that we can't show today what's going to occur. But if we can prevent something from ever occurring, if we can mitigate the impact, then I would suggest we can continue to make Minnesota one of the strongest and healthiest states in the nation. And I do want to thank you for your support of public health in the past and look forward to that in the future. Thank you, and if there are any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I would want to say that the website is, there's unbelievable amounts of information there. So if you have questions on health care in Minnesota, that's the place to start, I think. I think Representative Rood had a, well, first of all, I did want to recognize Representative Bradley, former Representative Bradley, who's here in the audience, former chair of this committee. So how are you? Good. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I agree. It is a great website. I want to get back to the questions of the healthcare disparities.
Yes.
And you had mentioned it's $10.4 million for the millennium since 2001.
Mm-hmm.
My question really is, I have two questions. What are the populations? Do you have a division? I apologize, I came in late. I didn't want to interrupt the group. How are you identifying the populations? Are they African American? Are they immigrants? Do you have a subdivision for immigrants? And also, how have you seen your numbers change? Because I know we have an increasing population, an increasing immigrant community.
Well, I'll start, and then when we get into funding, Margaret can address that. We have in our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, and I can talk about that particular office, we have five health coordinators, and they represent the Minnesota's African American and African, the Urban American Indian, the Latino, the Asian American, and the tribal governments. So each of those particular populations have a coordinator that then can work with those particular communities. Now, certainly when you begin to look at disparities and minority population within Minnesota, I know that we have many more nuances than that. But that is how we, the people that we have. We have 87 grantees, I believe, that receive money from that office, through that office, and those are more than just these five particular coordinators and groups. And that is going to depend upon the grant proposal around a particular topic, working with a community. So it's wider than just those five. As far as actual funding, Margaret can answer those.
Numbers too. I'm wondering about if the funding has been relatively stable. I think I'm a healthcare provider myself, and I know my population has greatly changed since 2000, and I'm wondering how that's being reflected by what you're seeing.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the funding at the department for these grant programs has been relatively stable since we began the grant program. I don't know if there's anything else here.
I'm just wondering, are there numbers out there as far as the population that we're trying to help? And look at their with the disparities. Am I making sense? I'm sorry if I'm not very clear.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do have in our budget narrative, which I did not bring with me today, but I know it's page 42. Oddly enough, I know it's page 42. Some statistics on performance measures that indicate specifically in the area of infant mortality, we have achieved some remarkable progress in reducing the rates of infant mortality in populations of color. We have a ways to go still to reach the targets we were trying to achieve, but in one or two of the populations, we've gotten there. So.
I'm just going to follow up on that point quickly. What specific things are you doing on infant mortality to get at that issue? I mean, what are you seeing as the most important piece of that?
Let me jump in there first, Mr. Chair. When, I believe it was in 2003-2004, again, when the report came out and said that Minnesota was the healthiest state in the nation, when you start looking below, you begin to see the disparity. And one of the things that jumped out very, very clearly at that point was the rate of infant mortality, particularly in the African American community. And it was like, that's not okay. What can we do about it? And so that was actually a partnership with Hennepin County, I believe, Ramsey County, and our department working with the community to say, this is something we have to take on together. One of the things that this particular office is very clear about is that you don't go into communities and do two communities, you work with communities. And so a group was pulled together about what can we do to really have an impact. And that led to the Save 10 campaign. And that was, if we can save 10 infants and at least get them to age one, we will have had a profound impact on that number. And I don't know if any of you saw or had an opportunity, but the community came together and we had an ad agency that donated some time, and there were some graphic posters that then showed up at bus stops and at key places that when I first looked at them, I went, oh my gosh. But it was, the message was strong. The message was very strong, and we believe that that has had an impact. We have seen the numbers go in the right direction.
Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, could you show us slide 5 again? Do you want to discuss what happened in 1918 about public health issues?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, I would love to. I have all kinds of stuff, but I tried to shorten it. The blip in 1918 is the pandemic flu. And that is what, at that particular point, more than 10,000 Minnesotans died as a result of the flu pandemic. And when we talk about all of our preparation and in light of preparing for another potential pandemic that we really believe experts tell us, it's not if, it's when. Estimates are that we would see potentially 33,000 Minnesotans die, worst case scenario. We estimate that 1.5 million would be sick and would require hospitalization, not all hospitalization, but would be sick. And we're just talking Minnesota numbers. And so that is part of why we are very, very focused on preparedness, both from a terroristic point of view, but also from a pandemic preparation. It is something we take very, very seriously. And in fact, on the 29th, we will be having an exercise related to school closings in the event that we have an issue of preparedness or pandemic flu and how we would play that scenario out. So thank you, Representative, for asking.
And just on that point, and I think we'll probably be spending a lot more time in Representative Huntley's committee on this issue, and I'm assuming there's going to be some money requests coming with regard to that. But is there any policy stuff you see coming, or do you have the tools you need at this point to get after that issue or the preparation?
At this, Mr. Chairman, at this particular point, we've got the authority as a result of the last 2 years ago. We received the authority for isolation and quarantine. That was huge. We believe we're in fairly good shape at this point in time.
Representative Murphy, I think, is next.
You answered my question.
Okay. Representative Norton had a question.
Chair Houston, Commissioner, I have a question and then a comment. The question was in regard to your WIC chart, and if you could, I wish I had a number and I don't have it. It was very difficult to read. I'm afraid I was spending too much time trying to figure out what the numbers and the letters meant, and I may not have heard what you said. But could you? There seems to be a very sharp increase over some number of years, and I can't read the numbers on my sheet, so that's why I was hoping you could pull it back up, and I didn't realize I had a screen behind me until it was too late. I'm looking to see, is the drastic increase due to more funding being made available, people meeting qualifications, changes in qualifications, all of the above, and then is there a need for additional funding, and I know that'll be you know, perhaps creating a different committee than this, but I just wondered, is that need, is that served, is that right?
Madam Chair, or excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I've been spending a lot of time in the Senate. This is a slide of the number of people served throughout the state through the WIC program.
And
so there has been a continual increase in the number of people accessing the WIC program throughout the state.
And has that been, if I might continue, if that has been because the need has increased, or is funding, or has qualification changed during that to make that increase rise so drastically?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe qualifications have changed, and I don't believe it's because funding follows the request for services. So as our caseload grows, federal funding increases to match our previous year's caseload.
Thank you for the clarification. And if I could continue, Chair, with my comment. I have a great deal of respect for the Public Health Department of State County. It's a wonderful organization, and I've worked closely with it. And so I'm going to put in a shameless plug for not necessarily Olmsted County, but my work with the Steps to a Healthier Minnesota project. And I think as state leaders, we need to be models. Role models. And so I have asked some of my friends over at the Department of Health to perhaps bring some of the Steps pedometers over, and I'm going to request some labeling down that used to be years ago in the hallway, so you'll know how far you walk. And I offered this to the freshmen, and I'm going to offer it to the committee as well. If you would like to join me in perhaps tracking your steps and being good role models for the rest of the state, please contact me, and I'll see that you get a pedometer in the paperwork.
Thank you. Representative Walker, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You hesitated. Were you? You're not trying to get healthy? Representative Norton, before I forget, actually one of the other things that has helped over the years with WIC is the increased outreach that the department's been doing with the cities and the counties. So can't forget about that. Love outreach. Got to make sure we have money for that. But I actually raised my hand to get on the list around the health disparity discussion we were having and wanted just to weigh in. There's a few different things to know. Not that things can't be done better. Things have been done better than to my expectation since we got the funding in 2001. As it relates to what you said, Mr. Chair, as it relates to an example, what you need to understand is we're talking about a statewide program that has diverse communities and diverse geographic boundaries. So communities are doing it themselves the best way that they can in their own area. So, for example, in past, monies have gone to an African-American storytellers, going into the community, talking to parents, talking to children about the importance of prevention and health things. So you have different things. There was an outreach situation that happened. I was just telling Representative Tsai how about this, where there was a 33-year-old African-American woman who had went in to be screened, didn't think anything was wrong, come to find out she had breast cancer. And after being screened, she had her sister, who was 31, screened, and she too had breast cancer. So these, some of the things that are out there are working. It's really put around what is going to be best to reach out to that particular person, that particular community. And so the work that you guys have been doing, I'm very appreciative. Representative Rude, when you wanted to know the numbers are hard to really get at, because there's the numbers that page 42 has. But I think your real question was, what is the population totals that we're looking at, and how are we getting, what are the resources and the amount of individuals that we're getting out to? And that's hard to tally up when you're doing a community event at Juneteenth and you're out there in the community. You don't know, you know, if you're keeping track of the 500 people that might have stopped by your booth, or if you're doing something at a powwow situation and individuals were able to get your message. And so trying to get that real hard number that you were looking for and how many people are being impacted compared to the amount of individuals that we have in the state is difficult.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was my question just related back to this slide that Representative Huntley referred back to, the one about life expectancy, and you don't really need to go back to the slide. It's okay. I just really wanted to ask sort of the academic question. When we look at life expectancy, I think most of us think of that as some measure about, you know, people are living to an older age. And in fact, if I remember right, it's a measure that has a lot to do with the chance of dying as an infant. Am I right? I just wanted to ask you for the very quick explanation of what life expectancy is so that it is more meaningful as we look at a graph like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would have to do some of this from recall. I can get all of the components that go into it, but you're right. It's more than just how, you know, when people are dying. It's the contributing factors. And so I can get that listing for you of what actually goes into life expectancy determination.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't really need that. I just wanted to sort of get the just the real quick, simple explanation so that it makes more sense, because Representative Huntley pointed out the dip
yes.
in 1918, and the way most of us think of life expectancy, you wouldn't, the sort of intuitive thinking is just because a lot of babies didn't make it 1 year, why should that change the overall life expectancy? But in fact, it does.
Yes, you're very right.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe what the chart shows is that at the point at which you're born, what is your life expectancy? And so because the life expectancy changes from year to year, each year a baby born this year may have a life expectancy of 72 years old. A baby born 5 years from now may have a life expectancy of 75 years. And so it's showing what the at the point of birth what your life expectancy was. So for babies born, I can't say more than that. I can't help you more than that.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up to Representative Walker's question on cancer. Just wondering, Commissioner, do you do statewide testing for all types of cancer in the state if requested by people who want or have a... knowledge of their background having cancer in their heritage lineage or something like that, and they want to have testing from, and they're low income or of sorts, can they get testing for cancer? Any type of cancer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we operate what's called the SAGE program, and so we really be part of breast and cervical cancer. We certainly provide a great deal of information around prevention and preventative screening, so regardless of gender, and do that. But as far as actually doing the testing, that would be provider-driven. It's not like the health department is going to be doing the testing. We are through, as I say, through the SAGE program. Low-income, underinsured, uninsured are able to participate in the program that particular way, but that's the main program that we run.
Thank you.
Representative Shumpert.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, at your new lab, do you do any testing for environmental toxins? I believe you test for nitrates at your lab.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm going to ask Dr. Crouch to come. He was the lab director until he moved on as assistant commissioner. He has the detail of what we can test for.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we test for quite a wide variety of different environmental chemicals that could be hazardous, okay? From organic chemicals to inorganic, like metals like arsenic and cadmium and mercury, and things of that nature. Nitrates, as you said, it's a wide spectrum.
And just to follow up on that question, can you talk a little bit about the reporting that you do, both kind of publicly and whether and to on individual stuff in terms of water testing, and then a little bit about there's a division between Ag and the Department of Health on some water testing. Am I correct about that? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is there's not a duplication. Certainly, we do water testing, and agriculture does water testing. They're more focused on pesticides in the environment and water, surface waters, whereas we are more focused on doing testing for regulatory programs like the Safe Drinking Water Act and others. And we do most of our testing in conjunction with the Division of Environmental Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
And just to follow, in terms of reporting of those results, I mean, is that a general testing, or do you let people know? How do you let people know what the test results are?
We don't do testing for private individuals. We're doing it for regulation. There are required samples to be taken because of the regulatory programs.
Thank you. And do you report that somehow? How do people find out about that?
this is reported, our data is reported to the Environmental Health or the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And they, of course, report that in summary form.
Just one more question on the regulation. Is there issues related? Can you talk a little bit about reporting with regard to children's, the levels that are toxic in children versus the levels that are toxic in adults? And do you, are there breakdowns in terms of the reporting on that?
Mr. Chairman, because we don't do individuals, we're not looking at individuals. Perhaps I don't understand.
Yeah, and I'll try to rephrase the question. When you test to whether something is meeting a regulatory standard, you have to have the standard in place. And I think there's some discussion that has been going on in recent years about whether that standard should be at the level of what's toxic to a child versus what's toxic to an adult. And can you tell a little bit of the work you've done and how that's progressing?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can jump in there. I think what you're talking about are the health risk limits.
Yep.
And where those are set. The lab is going to do the testing as a testing. The health risk limits are really a function of our environmental health area along with other clinicians to take a look at it and say, you know, what is the appropriate level of acceptability for a given compound in the drinking water. And so in some cases, some of those have a differentiation between adult and children, and certainly there is the ongoing discussion of whether the limit should just be at the children level because you cannot distinguish whether it's the adult or the child picking up the glass of water. And so that is an ongoing discussion, and the health risk limits are constantly under review based on the latest information.
Okay. I think we don't have to dig, go more further into that right now, but I think that might be something we want to talk about in the future. So
I understand. Thanks.
Any other questions that members have? All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now we're going to shift a little bit to the local health departments. Julie Ring and her representatives, thanks.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I guess I'll get that right. and members of the committee, my name is Julie Ring, and I'm the director of the Local Public Health Association. The Local Public Health Association represents all of the city and county health departments in the state of Minnesota. And we really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today and tell you a little bit about the local public health system and the work that we do. My goal is just to give you a few introductory comments and describe how the system itself is organized and financed, and then I'll turn it over to Sandy and Gretchen to tell you more about the actual activities, probably more interesting activities of local public health departments. We distributed a handout, I think you've all received that now, that describes what are called six areas of public health responsibility. State statute outlines broad goals that local health departments have to work toward. And these six areas provide a framework for the activities that we do toward those goals. We're going to try today to frame our comments around these six areas to give you an overview of the work that we do in all of them. And the comments that I make will fall primarily into the first area that's listed there of assuring an adequate public health infrastructure. But to begin with, I'd like to jump off of some of Commissioner Mandernach's comments and talk a little bit about what is public health or community health or population health. Sometimes we use a lot of different words to describe the work that we do and probably in some ways make it more complicated than we need to. For me, I think the simplest way to describe public health is through a contrast. While doctors and hospitals care for individuals one at a time, in public health, we're concerned with the health of a whole community. We do our work by trying to prevent illness in communities, and we attempt to resolve health threats that affect everyone at the same time. And just like doctors and hospitals, the work that we do is founded in scientific research, and the interventions that we do are based on science. Minnesota's public health system is a partnership between the state health department and local health departments. This is different than the social services system that you'll also hear about, which is a state-supervised and county-administered system. In public health, we work hand-in-hand with the state health department every day, and we're equally responsible for protecting the health of the public. And for that reason, we were very pleased to be asked to talk to you today alongside Commissioner Mandernut. Local public health departments are governed by Minnesota Statute 145A, which you'll hear us refer to as the Local Public Health Act or the CHS Act. It was passed in the mid-70s, and it created the CHS system that we have today. This system required local governments to form community health boards that served a population of at least 30,000 people. And so as a result, we have community health boards across the state that are multi-county and that are single county. And in the metropolitan area, we have 4 city boards. And as Commissioner Mandernach mentioned, there are currently 53 boards across the state. That's our governance structure for local health departments. We report to those boards. And it's the boards that are responsible for this first area listed on your sheet of assuring an adequate infrastructure. They do this by providing a local match for many state funds, by hiring a local public health director, by hiring a medical consultant, by ensuring that there's a process for local input into the public health work that they do, and many other basic requirements. I'd like to talk for just a second about how local health departments are funded. And on the back of that handout, you'll see 2 very high-level and not detailed at all graphs, but they give you a basic snapshot. Local health departments are funded by a combination of federal, state, local funds, and reimbursements and fees that are charged for some of the work that we do. As you can see from that grant, 50% of the funds that pay for our work are local. About one-third of our funds are actually local tax levy, but when you add in local grants and the fees that we charge for some of our services, you get to that 50% number. Most of the state and federal grants that we receive are what we would call categorical grants, in that they're narrowly defined, they're focused on a specific topic or a specific disease, and have very limited uses in many cases. And this at times can create a challenge for us, because often these categorical grants may be aimed at things that are not our greatest need in our local community. I see many of you nodding your heads, and you understand that that's sometimes a challenge for us. It's also challenging because, of course, categorical grants tend to be short-term, and it's very hard to build a budget on short-term funding. And those are some of the challenges that we face in putting together our broad local public health services.
Ms. Rink, can I just ask a question?
Sure.
You said local funds are one-third tax levies and one-third grants?
Of that 50%, a third of that pie would be local tax. The remainder of that 50% is local grants and fees.
And the local grants are coming from?
Various local sources.
They're not property taxes. Okay.
No, property taxes is the one-third. But when I say local grants, many local health departments may receive grants from local community groups of various sources. It would just be a definition of a grant that's not state or federal.
Thank you.
Sure. In addition, Commissioner Mandernach made reference to the Local Public Health Grant, and I'd like to talk for just a second about this source of funding because it's very important to us in local public health. This is a grant that was created in 2003, and it was created when a number of categorical grants were combined into one funding source, and unfortunately, of course, it being 2003, they were cut because it was a time of difficult budget time, as you know. But the Local Public Health Grant is actually made up of 3 sources of funds, one of which is state general fund. In addition, there's federal maternal and child health dollars and TANF dollars. The state general fund portion of the Local Public Health Grant is relatively small. It makes up 7% of our total budget, but it's one of our most important sources of funds, and you'll hear us talk about it a lot. It's our most flexible source of funding other than our local tax levy. And because of that, it's an important piece of funding for supporting our local needs. Finally, I just want to make a note for you on the line graph that I also gave you. That was just to give you a sense of the funding trends of those large categories over time. And just to explain to you that there's kind of a strange shift between 2004 and 2005 between the state funds and federal funds. That's actually based on a reporting change more so than an actual shift in dollars. the way the state is collecting the information, they're transitioning to, I think, better reflect the actual origin of funds. So in the past, if federal money came to the state health department and then was passed on to locals, it was reported as state money. And they're transitioning to more clearly defining that as federal money rather than state money. So that's one of the reasons you see almost kind of an inverse relationship between 2004 and 2005 in those funds. That's the dry material, the basic organization and finances. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Gretchen Musicant and Sandy Tubbs to talk a little bit more about the actual work they do in their local health departments. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Mr. Chair.
If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
I will. Okay. Members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Musicant, and I'm the Commissioner of Health for the City of Minneapolis. Kind of a lofty title, but it just means I'm...
Can I just interrupt for a second? Representative Trump, did you have a question?
Yes,
I did. On the previous stuff. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking in the graft, I was wondering if this is a statewide 50%, or is it... have you factored in rural and metro? Is it just the state?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, it's a statewide picture, and so it wouldn't show you how each individual local health department looks, nor is it a compare and contrast between how the metro or the rural looks, although those are numbers we could break down for you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and one more question. How do we compare with that 50% to other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, it's... I can provide you with a very detailed one-page handout that shows how each state's funding is broken down between local, state, and federal sources. Our national association did a very thorough statistical sampling of that. In general terms, most funding for local public health across the nation comes from local sources. In general terms, Minnesota provides less state funding than most other states do for local public health activities. When the most recent national survey came out, we were actually near the bottom in the amount of state funds that went into local public health, which, to be quite honest with all of you, shocked me a little bit because we tend to be fairly progressive about local public health. But I would be happy to find that piece of information and provide it to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more comment. The last thing, I'd read something about this lately, and it looked like Minnesota was the highest per money that they put into at the local level. In other words, 50% was the highest of any of the states at least surrounding us.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would say with some confidence that of the states surrounding us, we're probably the highest. Nationwide, we also do quite well, but I'm not sure exactly where our rank is.
Thank you.
But I'd be happy to get that for you.
Yeah, and if you could just send it to... Jen,
absolutely.
Thank you. All right. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Again, I'm Gretchen Musicant. I am the head of the City Health Department in Minneapolis. And this second part of our presentation, what we're going to try and do is give you a snapshot of some of the local efforts that our public health agencies are engaged in. And it is only a snapshot. It isn't by any means a comprehensive picture of what goes on across the state. And I hope in part of doing that, we're going to highlight some of the issues we're facing and maybe point you towards some of the policy opportunities that will be coming your way this session. I wanted to revisit just for a minute what Commissioner Mandernach talked about, which are the core functions of public health, and just give my version of a definition of them. The core functions are assessment, assurance, and advocacy. And the reason I want to do that is because it permeates really all of our work, and it affects how we go about working, and it also allows us to have the flexibility to do it differently in different parts of the state. Assessment is basically figuring out what the needs are in the community, and then once we initiate some action to figure out if that's working. So it's both an evaluation and an initial assessment. And it's based on data, but it's also based on connection with the community and talking to people and identifying issues through that mechanism. Assurance is making sure that something's being done about those issues and those needs. And I say it that way because sometimes it's providing direct services, but other times it's being a catalyst and pulling together people in the community to address an issue. And the third area is advocacy, which is promoting policy and practice changes to support efforts that improve health. And this can be advocating here up at the state level for changes in public policy or at the local level, but also working with clinics and providers and community organizations to address their small P policies and practices. As you can see, or maybe as you can hear, there's some nebulousness to what these functions are, but this is essentially the infrastructure we need. We need the flexible money that allows us to do this, figuring out and convening and cajoling and measuring and advocating. And it's the categorical funds that are more focused on specific health issues, which are augment that infrastructure, but the infrastructure needs to be there. Now I'm going to go into talking about some examples within these six areas of public health responsibilities. That's one of your handouts. And I'm going to start with one on the bottom, which is assure the quality and accessibility of health services. For us in Minneapolis, this means thinking a lot about the safety net. And by safety net, I mean those who care for the uninsured and providers who have specialized knowledge and experience in serving the underserved. And we feel that this safety net, while always precarious, is quite frayed. And we've seen increased evidence of this. There are clinics that have closed because of their disproportionate number of uninsured clients. There are other clinics that have had to pull back from serving special populations like homeless youth. Other parts of the safety net include the kind of public health nursing services that are delivered to the uninsured, providing dental services, which is a crying need across the state, and also programs like the Senior Black Nurse Program that help seniors stay in their home when they become disabled. From a policy perspective, I expect that you already know, since I was also here on Tuesday at your last hearing, that universal coverage and healthcare access is an important issue. When we looked at, in Minneapolis, our investment of our local dollars, our local public health dollars, and we divided them by goal, we saw that we spend a disproportionate share of our money on shoring up the safety net. And if we could have better access to health care, we'd be able to redirect those dollars to other issues like youth violence or obesity. Also coming before you, I believe, this session will be efforts to restore some of the cuts to the family planning dollars that occurred recently, and that is also another aspect to the fraying safety net out there. The second area I wanted to talk about is environmental health, protect against environmental health hazards, and I'm just going to talk about a couple examples there. One is food and beverage establishments. The state delegates food and beverage oversight to many local governments. And this includes ongoing education, inspection, and licensure, as well as investigating those foodborne outbreaks that make the news. A second area, and very close to my heart, is exposure to lead in the environment. For young children and childbearing women, this is an issue that impacts both their physical well-being and their ability to think and learn. There has been a national goal set to eliminate elevated blood lead levels in children by the year 2010, and we are coming close in Minneapolis. In fact, we are screening more children. 70% of the kids are screened, and we are finding lower and lower proportion of them have elevated levels in their blood, 3.5% at the last screening. But more needs to be done to get to that final goal. It's a tragedy if any child is exposed to lead and has their lifelong learning ability affected. Oh, you're just listening. Okay. And so I think that there will be proposals coming before you this session that might have to do with helping people replace windows, which is a key source of lead dust in the environment. And finally, I wanted to talk about the responsibility called Promote Healthy Behaviors and Healthy Communities. And this is a very broad category, so I'm only going to do part of it, and Sandy will pick up where I leave off. But the first area I want to talk about under that category is youth risk. And when we talk about youth risks, we look at things like violence and substance abuse and teen pregnancy, and the literature shows us that these risks are intertwined and that we can use similar strategies to address many of them, and that quality youth development is really kind of a silver bullet, if you will, even though it's a broad stroke intervention. As you may know, if you've read the paper or listened to the news, youth violence has been an issue of heightened concern in Minneapolis, and we have instituted a number of approaches to try and bring that down. But we've also looked at what changes in funding have there been in that magic year 2003. There were tremendous cuts to youth programming just in Minneapolis, and the state, we were surprised to see, is spending $4 million less per year in Minneapolis on youth programming now than it did before 2003. And I don't think we can separate that disinvestment entirely from a rise in youth violence. The second area I want to talk about is the growing concern about obesity, and Commissioner Mondanac talked a little bit about that. The state has a federal STEPS grant, and there are four local communities where that is implemented. One is Minneapolis, one is St. Paul, another is Rochester, and the fourth is Wilmer. And this grant looks at addressing and improving activity, nutrition, and decreasing exposure to smoke. And as Representative Norton mentioned and challenged you all, I had a similar idea. We have a campaign that started January 10th and runs through May 10th called Get Fit Twin Cities. And I brought some cards here to challenge you all to think about forming your own teams and challenging yourself to be more active. Councilmember Walker is one of our poster people. Yeah. Oh, representative. I'm so used to talking to that other body. And then finally, I'd like to speak about sexual health. And we see a lot of significant disparities in sexually transmitted diseases, teen pregnancy, and so we are augmenting the work of the disparity grantees with our own work, doing community outreach, and also working with clinical practice areas to encourage them to adopt easier and more acceptable testing methods. The policy areas that I think will be coming up related to this area is obviously the statewide smoking ban would have a high impact on exposure to secondhand smoke, and also the idea of restoring some of the tobacco endowment, which continues to come to the state, and direct it as it was originally directed towards reducing youth risk behaviors. I'm going to turn it over to Sandy now.
Good afternoon. I'm Sandy Tubbs. I'm the director of Douglas County Public Health, and I'm also a member of the Local Public Health Association. I'm as well very pleased to be here to be able to share with you some of what we do in local public health. I'm very passionate about local public health, and if my local county commissioners were here, they would tell you that sometimes that spills over into being a little wordy. So I took some notes so that I don't go on too long. But as Gretchen and Julie have told you, the work that we do every day really does center around those six areas of public health responsibility that you have in front of you. And it's also built on a foundation of prevention. Everything we do at the local level is really aimed at prevention. In the area of healthy behaviors and healthy communities, Gretchen has described for you some of what local health departments do in the area of youth risks and obesity and sexual health. Another huge area of need for prevention and education in that area is that of working with young families with children. Just as all of public health is based on science-based research, so too are the interventions that we do with young families with children. Unfortunately, I think you hear too much about these children and families when you hear about what happens when interventions are not offered to these families, and you hear about the consequences then of these families that have gone astray. Too often you'll hear about these children when they are forgotten, abandoned, abused, or neglected. And then sometimes you don't hear about them until they get a little older, and as adolescents they enter the correction system. Through intense public health home visiting, our goal is that you will hear less and less of those sad stories. The research is very clear in that intensive public health home visiting that's initiated during pregnancy results in healthier babies, improved growth and development, less child abuse and neglect, better learners in school, and greater self-sufficiency in those young families. You've often heard that children are a product of their environment, and that has been proven time and time again. And I think it's important to remember that a child's first environment is in the womb. And that is when and where the infant's brain first begins to develop. So a child that has been adversely impacted by prenatal chemical abuse or physical abuse or emotional abuse, that child enters this world with a pre-existing condition. And that condition will follow that child throughout their lives. Public health nurses who are able to work very closely with those pregnant moms can and do have a very positive impact on that child as well as that family. The human benefit, I think, is just about immeasurable. And the more children and families that we are able to reach, the more that benefit spreads from those individuals out into the community. And so what you will see are healthier communities. The financial impacts are significant, and I think they're also very well documented. But it takes a lot of time, and it takes a dedication to working with these families one-on-one so that eventually we will see healthier communities. Another area of public health responsibility is the area of preventing the spread of infectious disease. And I think never has our work in disease prevention been more challenging than it is right now. Not only are we sort of on the lookout for new diseases that seem to be lurking around the corner all the time, but now we're also challenged by the reemergence of some childhood diseases that we really thought that we had beaten. At the local level, public health departments are continually providing education, giving information, and really encouraging that dedication to getting our children immunized. And it seems like that should be a simple task, and yet it isn't. It has been very challenging. We, in our local area, witnessed the challenge of reemergence of childhood diseases when a child in Todd County actually was recently diagnosed with polio. And certainly, we thought polio was gone. The response from that local health department was really incredible. As they went about contacting all of the families in that community, offering vaccinations to those families, and providing information and referral for them, they were successful in preventing the spread of the disease. And one of the reasons that they were so successful is because they had an existing relationship with those people. The people, the public health staff at the local level, knew those community members, and they were trusted by those community members. So that's just one example of the value, and not only the value, but the critical role that I think local public health plays in preventing the spread of infectious disease. And now we have tuberculosis, we have pertussis, we have hepatitis B that seem to be on the increase, along with the annual threat of the seasonal influenza, as well as the likelihood of a pandemic in the near future. And so we are continually on high alert. Our efforts to prevent the spread of disease takes us to the homeless. It takes us into the schools, into the nursing homes, and into the businesses in our community. We are delivering those messages about covering your cough, as Commissioner Mandernach was talking about, and stay home when you're sick. We're sometimes put in the position of being little mini detectives as we try to go around and locate those individuals who may have been exposed to a communicable disease so that we can offer referral and resources to them and, again, prevent the spread of that disease to the rest of the community. Every day we receive calls at our office about infectious disease questions from the public. Sometimes they're asking us about the risks of international travel. The next call will be about how to treat head lice. The next question will be about avian influenza. The point is that they really see us as their resource, they call us, and they expect that we will provide them with the information. Last but not least is the public health role in working on preparing our communities for disaster. In Minnesota, we're pretty familiar with ice storms and tornadoes and floods. But we also have to be prepared for the impact of widespread disease and bioterrorism. Regardless of what the threat is, we need to remember that the response happens at the local level. Our public health role in emergency preparedness is very similar to all of the other areas, and that is, as Gretchen said, we bring people together. We mobilize our local resources, and we mobilize our financial resources to prepare and educate the citizens in our community. It's all about the relationships that we have, the relationships with our other response organizations, and the relationships that we have with the public. They recognize us as a credible source of information. And so we work with schools, we work with youth groups, we work with service organizations, we work with church groups. And we hope when the time comes that all of our efforts will pay off. So whether we're large or small public health departments, we all share these six common areas of public health responsibility. One of the unique things about our local public health system, though, is that we are able to assess and address those issues which are unique to our own communities. Sometimes those priority public health issues will be statewide issues, such as preventing the spread of infectious disease or adolescent risk behavior. But sometimes those priority issues are very unique to our own communities, such as a specific environmental health hazard. That's the strength of our local public health system, is that we are able to assess and address those issues that are specific to our community. So in closing, it's often said that if we do our job well, you won't know that we're there. And I think that too often that's true. So our message to you is we want you to know that we're there. We want you to know that we need your support. And we want you to know that we're willing and able to do whatever we're asked to do as long as we have the infrastructure and the resources to do that. Thank you. I'm sure we would take some questions.
Yes. Any questions from members? Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to publicly thank the department for that. I had the polio piece in my area, and they were quick. They were there. They were awesome, quite frankly, because we have a large population that isn't immunized, and not even the group that we founded in, but in many of our homeschoolers not now doing immunization. So I just want to publicly thank you for moving fast and it not going any farther.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. You talk a lot about these six areas, and it's a broad area of work. And you refer at times, especially Ms. Tubbs, to the smallness. Can you just draw me a concrete picture of who does the intervention? You know, what is the depth of the size of the department, and who's doing the work? If you could just draw a little picture for me, that'd be great.
Well, I can draw you a picture of Douglas County Public Health, and I can tell you that we have approximately 45 staff people, primarily public health nurses. But we also employ sanitarian, social worker, health educators, and then a large number of support staff that help us to get that work done. It varies significantly across the state. Some of the very large public health departments employ their own epidemiologists. We are not large enough to be able to do that. Some of the very smallest public health departments actually only have a couple of staff people. And so they kind of wear all of these hats that Gretchen and I just talked about. So the size and intensity of the work across the state, I think, varies significantly. But what we each try to do is address those issues that are of the greatest significance to our own communities.
Do you have a follow-up? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our guests. I mean, one of the things I just wanted to emphasize, and I have had a chance to work in public health policy to some degree for Hennepin County, and that Sandy mentioned how it's a science-based effort. And I think that that's one thing that you'll see as we learn more about various components of health and human services, that this is really a really huge strength of our public health system, and that everything they do is based on science, on best practices, on research, on data, and trying to follow up. And sometimes I wish we had that in some of the other areas of our work. And I think that to their credit, you know, whether they succeed or don't, the data's there. They try and figure out what worked, what didn't. And I think some of the most success we saw, unfortunately, ended prematurely with the solution to the budget crisis of 2003, with the ending of the public health and investments through the tobacco endowments, in that they were set forward with what people thought was an impossible to achieve goal of reducing use of tobacco by 25% in 4 years, and they more than beat that. And they were just starting to make progress on the youth risk initiatives, and all of that came to a screeching halt. But I think that there really is some some ability to look to strategic investments and actually have some accountability for outcomes, which is a theme that I keep hearing increasingly.
I just had a couple of questions. You mentioned that there was an increase in some of the communicable diseases. Do we know what's going on with that? Why that's happening?
Well, we know that some of the communicable diseases, some of them are childhood diseases that I think are a result that we're seeing spread now, because there are more unimmunized children, and so again, trying to reach those families and stress the importance of childhood vaccinations. I think that there's also, with our fluctuating population and a lot of people moving around and a lot of new immigrants, we're seeing some reoccurrence or emergence of some of those diseases, such as tuberculosis and hepatitis B, in some of our new population coming into the state.
Mr. Chair, in addition to that, in the arena of sexually transmitted diseases, you have people who are coming of age and into an environment that it has risks that you always need to educate. And so you're never done. You always have a new influx of folks. And so we have to have continuous investments so that each generation, each new segment that comes of age is prepared.
Anybody else? Yes. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our testifiers. I've been hearing a lot in various settings about the coming wave of retirements as the baby boomers retire and the changes in workforce, and I wonder if any of you would care to comment on how that might be affecting or expected to affect your agencies.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Liebling. I will jump in only because I actually just returned from Washington, D.C., where I participated in a panel talking about the workforce challenges in public health. And so I can give you a little bit of information about Minnesota and nationwide. But yes, we have done some study in Minnesota. The State Health Department received a grant a couple of years ago now to do what we called an enumeration of the public health workforce, to really look at who was working in public health and to give us a picture of how old our workforce was. And I don't have this with me, but if I remember from 2 days ago, the average age of the public health worker in local and state public health in Minnesota is about 46 years old. And about 21% of the local public health workforce and about 38% of the state public health workforce will be eligible to retire within about 5 or 6 years. So those are huge numbers for us. In addition, we are facing an increasing shortage in the number of public health nurses, RNs, and LPNs that are working in public health for a variety of reasons, one of which is the aging of the workforce, another of which is there is an overall nursing shortage, and quite frankly, in government, we tend not to be able to pay our nurses as well as the private sector can. So throughout the state, we're not very competitive in our wages. And thirdly, we have a geographic problem in that in our rural areas, we tend to have even fewer workers. The primary workforce in Minnesota is nurses. There are a variety of people employed in local public health, but the backbone is certainly nurses. And nationwide, there is an incredible pressure on this workforce as it ages and as we are less and less competitive in our wages. It's something that we and the State Health Department have studied a fair amount over the last few years. And in Minnesota, we're trying to do some creative things. We're attempting to draw more people into public health professions, not just nursing, but other types of public health workers to work throughout the state by focusing even at the high school age as well as the undergraduate age to find people who are interested in science and then try to explain to them and describe our field in a way that makes it appealing. So I mean, this is a fairly long-winded answer to your what seems a simple question perhaps, but certainly the aging of our workforce is creating stresses for us, and it's something that we have to find a sweeping way to address because it's not a single agency problem.
Representative Bonner.
Chair, and there's another half of the question that Representative Leverlin raised, which is you address the supply side from your side. But on the demand side, how is the aging of our population affecting the demand for the types and mix of services that you do currently? It sounds like a good portion of what you do is aimed at a younger population, you know, mothers, children, school age, those kinds of things. So what is happening in terms of the aging demand for your services?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we at our local public health department actually have probably about half of our staff that work with our aging and disabled population. And what we are seeing is that we can barely keep up because we are seeing more and more, and I think this is just the very beginning of what we're about to see. In terms of the number of elderly in our community that are looking for services to be able to help support them in their own homes, in their own communities, services that that enhance their health and well-being, they are the new elderly, the younger elderly are more demanding, as I expect that we all will be as well, and so their expectations are quite high. And so what we are seeing is that population that we're working with is just increasing incredibly fast, and we are scrambling really in terms of being able to provide the kinds of services that they are expecting, but also that they are needing in order to keep them in the community.
Thank you. Anybody else? Well, thank you for coming down today. And I think this was, it was very valuable to me, but one of the things that's interesting, like the comment about the crime in Minneapolis and kind of looking at it as a public health issue, and I think that actually is useful, not just with regard to crime, but with regard to a lot of issues. I think the paradigms from public health can help us a lot. So anyway, thank you for coming down, and I really appreciate it. I'm going to, Representative Bunn is going to renew her motion to adopt the minutes now that we have a quorum. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Those are adopted. Anything else anybody has? Okay. On Tuesday, we're hearing Representative Loeffler's bill on HSAs, and we're going to hear from the Departments of Health. Some of you may not know this yet, but we are on the report that just came out on uncompensated care and some hospital error reporting. So, thank you. We're adjourned.